complete with the sounds of Vrindavan? And the dust of Vrindavan? Very beautiful altar. Who is responsible for this one? Several. Time when any devotional service performed, and you all did so much devotional service during that yatra, hundreds of times amplified. You've had some time to recover afterwards, and quite honestly, largely to reciprocate with all of you in your devotion. I thought, let's do this again like we did last year. Some discussion on topics from Srimad Bhagavatam. And when considering the subject matter, there's so many nice things from Srimad Bhagavatam. But very famous from the Srimad Bhagavatam are the prayers of Queen Kunti. And there's a reason why they're very famous. They're so powerful. There's so much inspiration. So many nice lessons from Queen Kunti, mother of the Pandavas. The Pandavas are great. Prabhupada would sometimes say to the parents, when he would meet the parents of devotees, he would say, you can understand from the quality of the fruit, the quality of the tree. Where there's good fruit, it's a good tree. The parents would appreciate. And your son or your daughter, they're such good souls, such good persons. Therefore, so Queen Kunti, she's the mother of Yudhisthira, Bhima, Arjun, Nakula, and Sahadev, and all of their wonderful pastimes and their intimate relation with Krishna. And she's their mother. So, naturally, the message that Queen Kunti presents is a very great message. First, just make a little backdrop, just like part of the arrangements for the altar. You have a nice cloth, nice bed. You put these things down before you put the deity on the altar. So I'm going to do a little backdrop first. Queen Kunti as we know from her childhood, even in her childhood, she was very elevated personality. Such an elevated personality that she had received from Durvas Muni, no less, a benediction. Durvas Muni is a partial incarnation of Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva has this quality also. Easily pleased, easily angered. When he's angered, watch out for the anger of Durvas Muni, and when he's pleased, very generously he offers his benedictions. Even, of course, it's just Krishna's pastime, but even he offered benediction to Radharani. So the benediction that he offered to Queen Kunti was, whoever you call their name from the demigods, they will come at once and they will provide you with a child. So when she was a young girl, she served Durvas Muni so much to his satisfaction, he gave her this benediction. And as we know later on, that became important, very important. She shared this with her husband. She didn't share that Karna was first born. She just shared with her husband that something happened and he was not in a position where he would be able to produce a child. Because of a mistake he made and a curse he received. So she informed her husband of this benediction that Durvas Muni gave, but then expressed her reservations at exercising this benediction that Durvas Muni gave, because how could she, when she had her husband, receive the demigod and produce a son? Very interesting, because Mahabharata is filled with principles of Dharma. To hear Pandu's dharmic explanation of why that was okay, not only okay, she should do it, not only she should do it, she must do it. Very interesting set of, very delicate set of arguments. Mainly it rests on extraordinary circumstances. And so, these children were conceived. She then became the mother of the son of Yamaraj, the son of Vayu, the son of Indra. And Nakula and Sahadeva were born. And then after Pandu died, the decision was made that Madri would enter into the fire, funeral pyre. Sati was observed by Madri, and Kunti remained. She was the mother and father. She was the protector of these great souls, the Pandavas, in the absence of her husband. And when she returned back to the royal palace, there were other protectors, principally Grandfather Bhishma, who had no wife, but treated his younger brothers, Chitrangada and Vichitravirya, in the absence of their father, Santanu, he treated them as the older brother, like sons. He treated the Pandavas like sons. So he didn't have a queen, but he was very expert in the fatherly role. And Prabhupada has taught us the grandfather often shows more affection even than the father to the child. Naturally and understandably so. So grandfather Bhishma was like the father for the Pandavas, and uncle Vidura also. When Vidura, we read this, we discussed this when we were talking about chapter 13. Uncle Vidura was appreciated by Yudhisthira as one who, like a bird, spreads his wings or her wings and gives protection to the young baby birds. Vidura was like that. He was always giving his protection to the Pandavas. So they had their protectors, but Kunti was their dear mother. And because the Pandavas were filled with principles of virtue, they naturally gave great respect to their mother, not only religiously so, but with great spiritual qualification. She provided shelter for them, and they took that shelter from her. Kunti's simply indicating her word, some wish for her sons, just like the consideration that Arjuna had won Draupadi in her Swayambhar ceremony. Kunti's simply saying, without even looking, just hearing Arjuna as it happened, her indication was, simply her indication is that all five brothers should share property equally. So one wife should be shared by all the wives, by all the brothers. Just her word, boom, was done. They're so obedient to the instructions of their mother. So that's a little extraordinary in Vedic culture that a man may have more than one wife, but a wife being wife, more than one wife to multiple men. Five brothers having a common wife. Not so ordinary, but Kunti's words, so be it. When the Pandavas came back from their exile, Krishna also came. And Krishna was there to assist them in trying to bring a peaceful settlement to this issue of ruling. He became the messenger of the Pandavas. He brought the peace message. Please give them five states, five cities, five towns. And after the Kurukshetra battle, Krishna remained. He saw the coronation of Yudhisthira, and he remained for some weeks in Hastinapur. And Maharaj Yudhisthira and the Pandavas, they understood Krishna can't stay permanently. He has to return to Dwarka. He came to rescue and to assist in Earth, this great calamity. But he has his 16,108 wives. They're waiting for him anxiously. He has affairs of the state to attend to. He has the whole Yadu dynasty. They're very, very eager for Krishna to return. Krishna must go back. Yudhishthira was anticipating because he's very wise. Even without a word, he knew Krishna would want to return. So, sure enough, when Krishna came and informed Maharaj Yudhishthira, it's time for me to go. May I have your permission? How could he say yes and how could he say no? But he wanted to fulfill Krishna's desire, and so he made arrangements for a very grand, royal accompaniment of Krishna going back. The very next day was the planned time for Krishna's departure. And naturally, Krishna, being respectful to Kunti, like a son respects a mother, he wanted to secure Kunti's permission. She made that arrangement for him because she wanted to serve Krishna. This is this tension of the superior, neither party wanting to accept the position of superior. Kunti being seen as superior by Krishna because of her age and her position, like mother, the aunt of Krishna. Krishna's father and Kunti being brother and sister, so he saw her like his mother. And Kunti seeing Krishna as the supreme worshipable personality of Godhead, who somehow mysteriously and transcendentally has appeared as her nephew. Krishna was the Lord of her life. She wanted simply to serve Krishna. So she came to Krishna rather than Krishna having to come find her. And the scene is all the elephants and chariots and infantry and the whole royal assembly of all of Krishna's armies and the royal entourage. In front of Krishna and prepared to pour out her heart to Krishna with great love. And so that's the backdrop. In order to more deeply appreciate Kunti's words, it's important to understand the exceptional character very high. It is also important to understand the feelings of Kunti. Separation. The Bhagavatam, even in the first canto, again and again and again, there's lessons in this very important teaching of Vaishnavism, of becoming a devotee and being in devotion to Krishna. It is the intensification of love for Krishna through feelings of separation. Now, in our case, it's not the same. This kind of separation is the result of intense attachment. Our kind of separation is being covered by a cloud of illusion. That kind of separation. This is the separation of love being intensified. Attachment being intensified. Deep feelings of affection being intensified by imminent separation. It's very intense in a transcendental scale of things. Very intense situation. So that adds to the power behind Kunti's words. She speaks what she speaks with such feeling. Like Lord Brahma in his prayers to Krishna in the 10th canto after stealing the calves of the cowherd boys. Those prayers are very, very elevated. The subject that Brahma speaks, he's the original preceptor of the whole universe. He's the first one to receive transcendental knowledge. He speaks with such weight and such eloquence and gravity. But there's a very special thing about Kunti's prayers. She speaks with such intensity of feeling and love. She doesn't have the erudition and poetic skills. Adi Kavi Tene Brahma. Krishna, Lord Brahma, is the most learned person in the universe. Kunti's claiming the opposite for herself. Still, her prayers are very special because of the intensity of the feelings of separation that she's experiencing. And this, she says it specifically within her prayers. One cannot feelingly call out to the Supreme Lord unless one is in this position of having no other shelter but Him. It's an important theme in the whole of Kunti's prayers. And it's certainly an important theme in her life. She had no husband. She had difficulties and dangers and calamities again and again and again. If that happened to an ordinary person, any one of us, we'd be smashed. Kunti's the opposite. Bring the calamities again and again and again. Not because she was a masochist. She wanted that intensity of exclusive shelter in Krishna experience to intensify stronger and stronger and stronger. So, I think I'll let you do the translation summary of that, then I'll do the first verse. Go through text 43. So it's always nice to get a sense of continuity. Where does this begin? And the previous, an immediate previous event is that utera and the womb within utera, the child within the womb of utera, Maharaj Parikshit, were saved by Krishna. And everyone experienced it because in a similar manner, as Krishna was getting ready to go, utera ran to Krishna with great fear, not for her own safety, but for the safety of the child within her womb. Because the child within her womb was the only remaining heir, descendant to the royal throne. And Ashwatthama, the heinous, wicked personality, was attempting to kill that child within her womb. But Krishna personally checked. This is a different, Prabhupada explains. This Ashwatthama's releasing of her Mastra weapon was different. It was the second time he had previously done when Arjuna was pursuing him. And then his horse became exhausted, and so he got off his horse and released the Brahmastra when Arjuna was pursuing. This is a second separate incident. Specifically, the Brahmastra was aimed at the child within the womb of Utra. So, Queen Kunti, from text 17, thus saved from the radiation of the Brahmastra, Kunti, the chaste devotee of the Lord, and her five sons and Draupadi, addressed Lord Krishna as he started for home. Now, it's not explicitly in the purport, but in the verse, but in the purport, Prabhupada draws attention to this theme-like message, the no other shelter but Krishna mood of Kunti. Again, especially late amongst the ladies, you can think, here is this person of high virtue and high character and incredibly spiritually elevated individual with five sons and no husband, no pati, no protector. She knew Krishna as her protector. Not in the sense as husband. Sometimes Prabhupada would instruct like that to disciples that had, to female disciples who had lost their husband. She would instruct them, you make Krishna your husband. In the sense of finding exclusive protection and shelter in Krishna. Kunti had that from, even from the womanly side, what to speak of from the transcendental, completely spiritual side, even on the material side. She knew no other shelter but Krishna. And we know that Krishna reciprocates. Yayata yayam mam prapadyante tangstadaiva vajamyaham. Krishna reciprocates with the submission of his devotee. And from Kunti's side, she knew no other shelter. From Krishna's side, he was always there. And now he's going to leave. So that's the circumstance. Prabhupada writes, such a chaste devotee, pure devotee as Kunti, never asks Krishna for anything. But the Lord, out of his own accord, is always anxious to render whatever is needed. So we'll chant the verse. You have the verse? Sloka. Kunti uvacha. Namashe purusham tvadhyam.
Namashe purusham tvadhyam.
Ishvaram prakriti param.
Ishvaram prakriti param.
Alaksham sarva bhutanam.
Alaksham sarva bhutanam.
Antar bahir avastitam. Kunti is offering prayers to Krishna. In these first three, 18, 19, and 20, that's what we're going to cover this evening. She's expressing in a very concise and simple-hearted way some very deep and profound understandings about Krishna's position. We know that one cannot understand Krishna unless Krishna bestows his mercy and says, I am like this. He's unknowable. He's not knowable by scholarship, and he's not knowable by piety, and he's not knowable by anything except his disclosure. And he discloses himself to his devotee, and Kunti is demonstrating to us her devotion because she understands Krishna's position. His supreme position, his unlimited position, is uncompromised by any circumstance that he places himself in, position, fully transcendental, although he's appearing as her subordinate. So she's glorifying Krishna. And the second thing, as a theme in these first three verses, she's indicating her, a little bit her amazement, Prabhupada says, a little bit her bewilderment at the all-pervasiveness of Krishna and the localized nature of Krishna. So we'll cover this, these two theme-like messages in these first prayers. So it starts, Namashe Purusham Tvadhyam, just as we have in Lord Brahma's prayers. Krishna is the Adi Purusha. Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. From his position of being the Adi Purusha, he does so many things. And the prayers of Lord Brahma, they indicate the so many things that he does and is. But the refrain is Adi Purusham. He, the absolute truth, is the source of all things. And at the same time has no other source. Here in this world, we can be the mother or father of some children. But we have a mother or father. The Adi Purusha, he's the mother and father of every mother and father. And he has no mother and father. This is the first thing Kunti is indicating. He's the original source. He has no mother and father. The source of everything. Which then naturally leads to the other feeling that Quinty has of he's respecting me like his mother. She can process that, but it's a little difficult because she sees him. Imagine, you know, standing before a person, Krishna, knowing actually you're the source of everything. Fully, consciously, like to the bone, to the core, realizing that. It's hard to even think what that might be like, but that's what Kunti's doing. He's on his chariot. He's getting ready to go back to Dwarka. Krishna gets off his chariot. He comes and touches her feet, offering her respect. Please give me your blessings that I may have a safe journey back to Dwarka. Namaste Purushamadhyam. Ishwaram Prakrite Param. You're in a fully transcendental position. Prakrite Param. You're the controller of this material energy. You're never come under the control of this material energy. Now, these first two lines, they're one of the things that they're doing is they're establishing the Siddhanta, the conclusion that Krishna is not an ordinary living entity, because ordinary living entities, as indicated, we can be mothers or fathers, or we can't be motherless or fatherless. We can't be the mother and father of all. A living entity can't do that. That is Krishna's position. He's the Adi Purusha. And we're Chuta, and he's Achuta. The Achuta-ness of Krishna is in the second line. Ishwaram Prakrite Param. He never comes under the control of Prakriti. He's always in the control of Prakriti. It's his energy, it's under his direction, never otherwise. He's a Chuta. Or Chuta. And one who takes shelter of Krishna becomes a Chuta. At least becomes in the Achuta Gotram, in the family of Krishna. In South India, I was visiting, I was taking part in an inauguration of a temple, and some Sri Vaishnavas were performing the yajna, and I was to establish the inauguration of the temple. And I was asked to be the presiding personality with this function. So when the priest came to the part where, you know how in Vedic rituals you say the name of the person and you're supposed to say their gotra. So he, Prabhupada had trained us in the answer to this question. He asked the temple president, what is his gotra? The Chuta Gotra. So the priest nodded and said, Chuta Gotra. Then he asked him, what is your Gotra? Chuta Gotra. From the same family. We're of the same spiritual family when we're initiated in this line of the disciplic succession of a Chuta. That's what initiation means, what's accepted by the disciplic succession as part of that same spiritual family. The formal It's like, you know, when you get married, then you'd have a certificate. You're legally the husband and wife. And you're bound by the laws of husbands and wives, the laws of the land. And a religious ceremony where it's not recorded in the deed of the Bureau of Records, but in the spiritual sense, is the spiritual connection is established. That's why there's this term dvija is used. There's ja and there's dvija. And the second birth is a spiritual birth. And that spiritual birth into the family of Krishna. So, Krishna is achyuta. He's infallible. And what is the mark or the characteristic of this infallible position? Although he appeared in this world as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki, the brother and sister-in-law of Kunti, Ishwaram Prakrite Param Namaste Purusham Adhyam. I know, I've got your number. I know who you are. Right off, first thing, I understand who you are. No doubt in my mind. Prabhupada indicated that when Krishna was on the planet, very few people actually understood Krishna's position. Right away, the Pandavas, they understood Krishna's position. Even they understood Krishna's position. Krishna took the position sometimes subordinate to them as the chariot driver in relation to Yudhisthira. He offered his respect to Yudhisthira like the Pandavas offered their respect to Yudhisthira. He came and would bow before Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira understood Krishna is the personality of Godhead. Krishna would come and bow before Yudhisthira. And Yudhisthira didn't interfere with Krishna's feelings, transcendental feelings. He embraced Krishna to his chest. How elevated is Yudhisthira? Grandfather Bhishma, he understood who was Krishna. Kunti understood who was Krishna. Prabhupada said, and a few more, a couple handful of people. Otherwise, everyone was in this bewildered state, not clearly understanding Krishna's position. Vyasadeva, Prabhupada indicated, he understood Krishna's position. Kunti's among those that clearly understood. I'm driving at this point because it, to me it's just like, how do you relate to a person who they're walking across the room and that's the personality of Godhead? And they come and touch your feet. But that's the elevated position of the Pandavas and Kunti. She was doing as she was doing as service to Krishna. Krishna wants, he's pleased by this. Krishna should be pleased. That's all. She knew nothing else and cared for nothing else. Such an elevated position. Because of that complete dedication to Krishna, she had access to actually understand his position. Others that don't have that dedication don't have access. They may theoretically read it in a book and say, oh yes, that's very interesting. But she was in that consciousness at all times. That's Queen Kunti. Then comes this other while she's clear in one area, she's uncertain in another area. Or she's appreciating the mystic opulence of Krishna. Alaksham Sarvabhutanam. Sarvabhutanam, all living entities. Alaksham. They cannot see him properly. In the translation, Prabhupada writes, you are invisible to all. Now they could see Krishna, but they couldn't see who is Krishna. Alaksham Sarvabhutanam. Even though Antar Bahir Avastitam, you're both outside and inside of every living entity. You're everywhere, and people cannot see you. So this Vedic concept of God exists everywhere, the all-pervasiveness of God, is a common in all religious doctrine. Not only Vedic scripture, all religious doctrine, God is everywhere. It's common. And one way that he's everywhere is he's in the heart of every living being. So there's this Brahman conception, a Paramatma conception, but then also the Bhagavan conception. The Paramatma conception is he's localized. Right? The all-pervasive feature, the localized feature, and the personal feature. She knows that Krishna, try to appreciate this, she knows that Krishna is situated in the heart of every living being. There he is, standing before her, and she's saying, I know who you are. You are the Lord who is within the heart of every living being. So he's all pervasive and he's localized at the same time. That's a difficult adjustment for Kunti to make. Prabhupada writes, Queen Kunti experienced personally that Lord Krishna was present before her. Yet, he entered within the womb of Uttara to save her embryo from the attack of Ashvatthama's Brahmastra. Kunti herself was puzzled by whether Sri Krishna is all-pervasive or localized. Are you here or are you there? Because materially speaking, we can say, you know, we're in this room. But we can't say we're outside this room and in this room. We can go outside the room. We can't simultaneously be both. Krishna simultaneously, the answer to her puzzlement, which of it is Krishna's situation, correct understanding of Krishna's situation, the answer is both. For him, that's not a problem. Because he's not limited. Not limited. And Jiva Goswami, in his Sandarbhas, writes, very succinct statement, so listen carefully. There's no question of understanding God without accepting the fact that he has inconceivable potencies. There's the statement. Kunti's expressing her understanding of Krishna, and she's puzzled by the all-pervasive and the localized features of Krishna. That is reconciled easily if one accepts and is not at all, it remains a puzzle otherwise, by understanding Krishna's inconceivable potencies. By his inconceivable potencies, he can expand within the heart of every living being, and he's not reduced. He doesn't become less. Prabhupada's example, you take a piece of paper, you rip it into little pieces, and you can distribute it through the room. But then where's the original piece of paper? It's not there anymore. It's in little pieces all around the room. Because that's a physical or a limited object. But Krishna can distribute himself all over existence, and he still remains Krishna. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnam Padachate Purnasyam Purnam Adaya. That's Krishna. His inconceivable potencies are such, furthermore, that although he distributes himself in this way, he's existing in a localized, personal manner. He's also existing in this all-pervasive way. Antar Bahir. People cannot see him. That's another one of his bewildering. The bewildering condition is due to his bewildering potency. Yaya samohito jiva. The living entity becomes moha, bewildered by Krishna's maya energy. And when Krishna withdraws that maya energy, aha! Like Kunti, aha! People can't see you, although you're everywhere. And in the next verse, so I'm going to have you translate. In the next verse, Kunti's going to expand on this idea that Krishna is beyond the senses to perceive, or that hoax and judge. Just like this alaksham sarvabhutanam, he cannot be seen by all living entities, although he's everywhere. Therefore, he cannot be seen because of he's not approachable through material senses. Therefore, another name is adhoksacha. 19. Maya janavikanchanam agyanokshajam avyayam nalakshase bhutadrisha nato natyataro yata. Is amplifying a previous understanding, the understanding that Krishna is beyond the range of the senses. This is a very important philosophical concept. It's an important devotional concept. The philosophical concept is. We're to use these senses to serve he who is beyond the senses. That is a mystery. The very word adhoksaja is used in the first chapter of, excuse me, this is the second chapter of the first canto. When the essence of all the knowledge of the Vedas is the question, and the answer is given, serving adhoksaja. What is that verse? Savai pungsang paro dharmo yato bhaktir adhoksaje ahoitokiya pratiyata yayatma supraseedati. That verse is the first answer to the six questions of the sages of Naimisharanya. The first question is, can you please summarize the essence of all the knowledge of all the Vedas? Because people need to Kali, they won't be able to understand it otherwise. So please make it really simple. Pablamized, pre-digested, easy to swallow. Essence of all the Vedas. Savai pungsang paro dharma yato bhakti adhoksaje. So bhakti teaches. Bhakti is the root word of bhakti is bhaj. Prabhupada explains this in the final purport of chapter 6, where bhakti is the uttama form of yoga. Bhakti comes from bhaj. Bhaj means practical activity, senses, engaged with objects of the sense, something that's a no-no for tyagis and dhyan yogis. You're supposed to withdraw your senses. Bhakti yogis are supposed to engage their senses in objects in the spirit of devotion. And by that method, realize Krishna. It's not armchair philosophy. Because Krishna is all-pervasive. And Krishna is realized through the medium of bhakti. So we're to realize he who is beyond the senses through the medium of engaging our senses in the spirit of devotion. So it's the operative principle is the spirit of devotion, not the senses meaning sense objects. Because generally, the senses meeting sense objects produces duality. If you haven't noticed, it produces duality. Attraction and repulsion. I like, I don't like. I'm happy, I'm sad. It's wet and it's dry. It's light and it's dark. Pleasure and pain. And so, the impersonal conclusion would be, just stop that process. Just anesthetize your senses, or muzzle your senses, or put your senses in a straitjacket. Don't use your senses. Be sense-controlled in a negative sense, in a negative connotation. Not like that. In the spirit of devotion, realize Krishna in everything that you do. And who is it that you realize? Adhoksaja. He was beyond the senses. Krishna standing before Kunti, and she's saying, you're Adhoksaja. She's powerful. Adhoksajam Agyadhoksajam Avyayam Avyayam. This word appears in Bhagavad Gita also. Avyayam means, what was it? Does anybody know the verse? Bhagavad Gita buffs in the audience. Help you. Krishna indicates that the foolish people, mudhas, they think that Krishna has assumed a physical form, then he's not an oksaja, he's aksaja. He can be seen with his eyes. But such persons that think like this, they think that he's mortal or embodied, they do not know his higher nature, which is changeless and supreme. So, this Prabhupada has translated this word avyayam as irreproachable. And that's not a word that he often used. It's not a word that we often use in the English language, irreproachable. There's approachable and unapproachable, but that's not the same. Reproach is, you can admonish someone, you can indicate there's a defect here. That's reproach. Irreproachable means pristine, is pure, is you cannot find a flaw in Krishna. Avyayam. In Bhagavad Gita, it's inexhaustible. The supply has no limit. Like Draupadi Sari. As much as Dushyanta tried, he got worn out. Pile, big pile of sari. Or anything. Krishna's giving strength. Krishna's giving material ingredients. Krishna's giving anything. He's avyayam. He's got a big warehouse. His another way of saying the same thing is his potencies are inconceivable. Each one of us is limited. Whatever strength we have, whatever ability we have, whatever wealth we have, whatever something we have, it's limited. Krishna's unlimited. So, you're at Hoksaja, and you're unlimited. And no one can find any spot, any reproachable part to you. But there are those that cannot see you at all. Maya Javani Kanchanam. You are eternally covered by the curtain of the deluding energy. Na lakshya se mudho mudhadrisha. You're invisible to the foolish observer. How is that? Nato natyataro yata. Yata, just like an actor is not recognized by his costuming, an actor on a stage. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his Navadvip Leela, as a young grihastha, he wanted to perform a drama. So he approached Chandrasekhar Acharya and requested him, would you host a drama? Would you create the stage and the costuming as I direct? Of course he did. It was a grand drama. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wrote the play. He designed the costumes. He designed the choreography, and he was the chief actor. Because he's the personality of Godhead, so everything comes from him. And when he chose as the part for himself the goddess of fortune, when Mother Sachi was invited to the drama, and she saw the goddess of fortune on stage, she was so attracted. She asked, "Who is this?" And when she was told, "This is your son," she fainted to the ground unconscious. This is in Chaitanya Bhagavat. They had to revive Sachi to external consciousness so she could watch the rest of the drama. She was attracted to the goddess of fortune like one is attracted to the goddess of fortune. She couldn't see the difference. She couldn't recognize her own son. So, similarly, what Kunti is saying is, worldly people see you according to the way in which you conceal yourself only. They see your deluding potency. They don't see you. Quite the opposite. The devotee sees Krishna despite his disguises. Or whatever leelas he may exhibit. In Kunti's one. You're at Oksaja. You're Avyayam. You're Antar Bahir. You're within everything and you're outside everything. You're Adi Purusha. They got your number. But others, they cannot understand. So it's a very, very wonderful purport where Prabhupada goes on about the various ways that Krishna exhibited his divinity and other forms of the Lord. They also exhibit their divinity. But ordinary people, they don't understand. God has become a hog. What kind of religion is this? Half man, half lion. What kind of mythology are you accepting as religion? They cannot see. Or this low character person, Krishna, they cannot see. One can see through the eyes of devotion only. So, in the purport, Prabhupada explains, here are some of, he gives three contributing factors why persons cannot see Krishna. They cannot see God as he is. One is poor fund of knowledge. They've never received any proper training. They cannot know without guidance and proper training. Another is, even when given proper guidance and training, they're stubborn. No good reason. This stubborn obstinacy. And then a third reason is, this is a Hoksaja reason, they want to have everything proved to them by seeing. Prabhupada would often say this, that people will ask me, "Swamiji, can you show me God?" And my answer is, "Do you have the eyes to see him?" If I were to show him. Once Prabhupada was asked by a reporter, "Swamiji, have you seen God?" And Prabhupada's reply was, "If I told you, would you believe me?" And the reporter said, "Yes, Swamiji." Then Prabhupada said, "Not only I have seen God, but I am seeing him at every moment. Do you believe me?" Because this is the condition one sees according to the quality of love. Premanjana charita bhakti vilochanena. Santaksadaiva ridayeshu vilokayanti. Yam shama sundram achintya guna swarupam. Govindam adi purusham tamaham bhajami. Prabhupada extols the virtue of deity worship. Deity worship, the archa vigraha, form of the Lord, is a merciful manifestation to people who don't have prema. They want to see God. So he makes himself available in a form that they can see. And therefore, Prabhupada writes that temple worship is very important for most people. So they can get some impression of the form of the Lord, that they can, coming before the form of the Lord, be in reverence, in a sanctified state of body and mind, observing the regulations so they don't make offense before the deity of the Lord. And it's not only in his purport, it's not only deity worship in Vedic culture, but churches, mosques, and synagogues, all the having places of worship is very important. It's particularly important for Krishna adhikaris. Prabhupada specifically says it's as important and it's as purifying for Krishna adhikaris as is the fixing of the mind in transcendence for an elevated devotee of the Lord. For less intelligent persons, bowing down before the authority of the Lord, as generally done in temples, mosques, and churches, is as beneficial as it is for the advanced devotee to meditate upon him by active service. And now we're back to the Yadhoksaja. If he is Yadhoksaja, how can we see him even in his deity form? By seeing the deity form, it doesn't mean, aha, now we've realized Krishna. But it's an opportunity for active service to serve the deity. Not just seeing the deity, active service, serve the deity by performing various services. Through the medium of that service, the divinity of the Archivigraha becomes disclosed. Same as the active service to the Srimad Bhagavatam and the person Bhagavatam. This is taught in the early part of the first canto. Great service is done by rendering service to the book Bhagavat and the person Bhagavat. It purifies one's existence. It removes the layers of material covering. That's purity. So that one can see Krishna in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam and see Krishna as he is disclosed through the representatives of Krishna. Otherwise, one can see the book as ordinary and the person as ordinary and make offenses. So, the perceiving of Krishna through active service, that's our method, that's bhakti. simply through that, through practicing like that, combined with deity worship and the chanting of the holy name. Those are our Panchratrika Vidhi and Bhagavat Vidhi systems of purification. Then we have all the other things we do in the course of the day. That's called devotional service. Whether it's you go to school, or you go to the office, or you go to the marketplace, or you go visit your friend, or you take care of your family members, or whatever the service, there's so many services. You go to the kitchen, you do the different services that you do. It's not just the activity, it's the consciousness behind the activity. In the spirit of devotion, then the meditation upon the personality of Godhead is taking place because of that spirit of devotion. Attachment to the Lord is strengthened, and the disclosure of the Lord because of that attachment for Him. He discloses Himself, I'm like this. That's how the process of bhakti works. So Prabhupada's statement here is the deity worship for neophytes and everybody is as important as the meditation upon the Lord through the medium of active services for the elevated soul. You'll say the Paramahamsa, Parivrajakacharya, the topmost stage of devotee who's traveling here and there may not maintain worship of deity, but they're worshiping the Supreme Lord by their every activity, by their Paramahamsa activities. So, once again, it's the principle of fixing the mind in devotion upon the Supreme Lord, who is beyond the senses. That's what Kunti is saying here. Translation again. Limited sense perception. You are the eternally irreproachable factor covered by the curtain of deluding energy. You are invisible to the foolish observer, exactly as an actor dressed as a player is not recognized. Paramahamsanam Muninam Amalatmanam Bhakti Yoga Vidhanartham Tatam Pashye Mahi Sriyaha. Here Kunti is speaking in very humble way about herself. Double humble, because she's already indicated she knows Krishna's situation perfectly well. Now she's saying, how is it possible for a woman to understand Krishna's position? When even greatly learned persons with powers to speculate like women generally don't have, they can't understand Krishna. So how can we understand Krishna? Indirectly, the indication is these are not the qualifications for understanding Krishna. The qualification for understanding Krishna is one's devotion, one's love and submission to Krishna, one's spirit of service to Krishna. And Krishna discloses, I am like this. And unless Krishna discloses, one cannot know. You yourself descend to propagate the transcendental science of devotional service unto the hearts of the advanced transcendentalists and mental speculators who are purified by being able to discriminate between matter and spirit. How then can we, women, know you perfectly? This is the nature of a highly endowed person, is that they're incredibly humble. As the common saying goes, the tree that's laden with so much fruit hangs very low to the ground. And the barren tree, with pride, extends his branches high into the air. The humble person doesn't need to demonstrate their qualification. Their qualification demonstrates itself. And one of those qualifications, or one of the decorations, is a great degree of humility. And Queen Kunti is exhibiting that quality here. Now, for those of you that are will be called upon to explain this thing that seems to come up again and again, that women don't like and some men also don't like, is that women are in this lesser position, the inferior position. Why is the scriptures, sees all pandita, samadarshana, sees everyone equally, say these deprecating things about women? And Prabhupada's answer is here in the lecture that he gave on this particular verse. He explained it very clearly. And the statement is simply indicating that, as Prabhupada said in the lecture, historically, the great philosophers, those who ponder and speculate, split hairs over so many subject matters, generally it's men that do those things. The propensity for mental speculation is greater in men. So that's actually a credit to the women. They don't waste their time with such speculation. But that's what the understanding. But they're blessed by the Lord because they believe at once in the superiority and almightiness of the Lord, and thus they offer obeisances without reservation. Or as Prabhupada explained in the lecture related to this verse, all over the world we find that in religious assemblies, women are there in greater number, except for this one. Generally is the case. Women are there in greater number. Because there's a natural, soft-hearted willingness, eagerness to worship and offer prayers to the Lord and submit oneself. And men have this ego thing. I don't want to submit myself to anybody. I want to be really, you know, I want to make my decisions in life, etc. Tendency. Male egoistic pride. And the simplicity of women to just surrender to Krishna, worship Krishna. So that's an important detail. This will help you in the future understanding this point when you have to address this question, why these remarks? It's actually a credit. And in Kunti's case, it's simply her genuine quality of humility. And in this world, when people exhibit humility, materialists take it as a sign of weakness. And sometimes devotees are cautioned by well-wishing non-devotees. Don't be so humble. People will take advantage of you. I had this experience on more than one occasion, but one is particularly memorable. It was in New York City on Fifth Avenue. We were having Harinam Sankirtan on Fifth Avenue, and I was distributing literature along with the Harinam party, and I got in this conversation with this very well-dressed man, very impressive person, from a, you know, worldly view, and he, let me give you some advice. Don't be so humble. People will exploit you and take advantage of you. I said, I don't feel exploited or taken advantage of. And if, even if someone tried to do that, what can they do? I don't have anything they can take. He smiled and said, that's your character. But a devotee doesn't think like that. But, you know, of course, worldly people may very well try to take advantage. Just like when Sanatan Goswami had escaped from being under the control of Nawab Hussein Shah, and he was moving through the ramparts, through the hills, tracts of land, and Ishan was carrying some gold coins. You know the story. So as he was approaching, what astrologer had calculated, this person has great treasure with him. He told the innkeeper. The innkeeper made a plan that he would kill him. And sure enough, Sanatan Goswami came. Oh, how nice to see you. Please come. I'll give you a room. And treated him so nicely, Sanatan Goswami could understand, because he was expert in diplomacy, this man wants something. People don't normally do like this. Ishan, do you have any money with you? Are you carrying gold coins? Yes, I have one gold coin. And when he had three. So, Sanatan Goswami immediately went to the innkeeper and gave him the gold coin. And the innkeeper said, this is very good, because otherwise I was going to kill you in the dead of night. Now you've given me the gold coins, you spared me from that act of murder. So now I will help you go to your destination, and you can have your gold coins back too. And Sanatan Goswami said, you keep the gold coins. It'll happen again in the next place. Better you keep the gold coins. Then he told Ishan, you can keep the coin that you have. Okay. So, there's a natural disposition. One of the qualifications of a devotee is simplicity. According to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, this is the number one quality that makes a person a devotee, is simplicity. So this is a nice quality to consider. Simplicity, it has several connotations. One of them is, you just speak the truth. Whatever it is. You're not cunning and conniving and duplicitous. We have words for that in Hindi. You're just straightforward. Straightforward simplicity. Another meaning or connotation to simplicity is you keep yourself simple. You don't need clutter and things. some homes you go, I go into, and there's just knickknacks and stuff all over the place. And some homes you go to, it's just very, the necessities are there, and that's it. Very simple. A devotee likes living like that. What's necessary only, and otherwise, simplicity. So that I can, my attention can just go to what's important, my relationship with Krishna, and not knick-knack and clutter and, you know, consumerism. No, persons having that quality are not good for the gross national product of the country. You have to want to consume more and more. That's good. When people are in the mood of spending, the economy is in the rise. And the industrialists can really take advantage of that consumer mentality of the public. So pumping up the public through marketing and advertising. Consume. You got to have this to be happy. You got to have that to be happy. You got to have three of them to be happy. Different colors, different shapes, different sizes. Consume, consume. Then you'll be happy, happy. And then we'll be happy. Maybe you won't be happy. We'll be happy. Devotee is not caught up in that. Simple. What I require, that's it. As one of the signs of making spiritual advancement, Bhaktivinoda Thakur taught that people ask this question, how can I evaluate, how can I measure, am I progressing in spiritual life? One of the measures is my attraction for material things slackening? Is this quality of simplicity developing in my life? I just want shelter and spiritual and the other things as required. And otherwise, just not having an interest in them. People who are, I've had again and again devotees say that through passage of time of practice and Krishna consciousness, people will invite them, their old friends will invite them, would you like to da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they, no. It's not like, I really want to go, but you know, somebody might say something if I go. No. One Prabhupada disciple was describing to me a very wealthy, successful person. He had been working very hard and he felt he needed just to get away. So he did this thing. He leased a yacht, one of the Gold Cup winning something $8 million yachts, and the person that owned it was helping him, you know, steer and guide this yacht. I don't know if the yacht is the right word, but you know, like a sailboat that's really. And he told me when it was all over, it was those kinds of things, you know, excitement and challenge and used to really do something for him. Just doesn't do it. But we don't have to necessarily experiment with those things to see if it does it for me anymore. Just that's what happens. Just the glitter gold attraction of glitzy things. It subsides. And one's life then naturally becomes simple. Krishna shelter giving things only. And otherwise, this is where Yukta Vairagya. Comes in. One develops a distraction, dislike, disinclination. Bhaktir Parishano Bhavo Viraktir Anyatracha. By the process of, just as we're doing now, this hearing of topics related to Krishna, according to the scriptures, Srimad Bhagavatam, three things will happen. Devotion for Krishna, feelings of devotion for Krishna awaken in the heart. Para Isha Anubhav, a desire to serve Krishna, an attraction for Krishna, the supreme controller, and Viraktir, Virakti, detachment. Anyatracha, of other things. Bhakti, Para Isha Anubhav, Viraktir, Anyatracha. Just from hearing, just what we're doing right now, hearing and discussing Krishna Katha. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Regularly hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. Punya Shravana Kirtanam. I'm going to end with that and we'll do the translation, see if there's any questions you'd like to ask. Have to? Okay. Prabhupada has given, gives two-part answer. Prabhupada has given specific instruction for those whose occupation is merchandising, you know, vices. His statement basically is that goes with the territory. He would repeatedly give this particular example. He would say, the merchant will say, sir, for you I make no profit. But everybody knows he can't continue being Vaishya unless he's making profit. But he will say, I'm giving this to you at cost. You know that he's not giving it at cost. Or you should know he's not giving it at cost. Somewhere he's making some money. Because that's what he does. He takes something and turns it around and makes a little money. But it goes with the territory of being a Vaishya. So another, he gave the example, they sell a product that says you have a bald head, you rub this on your head and it will make your hair grow. And they'll buy the product. Although they know it's not going to make their hair grow. Like this, Prabhupada said, one who is Vaishya, it's required. It's part of the territory. So, in that sense, Prabhupada, I guess you could say, gave a certain license for Vaishatak. On the other hand, I said there's a two-part answer, so the other part is Prabhupada was very firm about in ordinary dealings being straightforward. So then it's connected to that. It's difficult that in some circumstances you speak something that's not true. In all other circumstances you always speak that which is true. As Prabhupada said, lie to some, not to others. That is not going to happen. So, therefore, it's better to live by the principle of always speaking the truth. I'll give a practical example here in Vrindavan. You go to Lloyd Bazaar, and there's many people, you know, wanting you to come to their shop. There's one shop that they don't do that. Rather, they built their business on the reputation of being honest with their customers. I don't mind saying the name of the place. It's Ganga Prasad. It's a cloth merchant. Many cloth merchants, you order this, you have them prepare it to stitch it to make a garment, and you get back something else. It's a different quality cloth, and then making a little something, giving you a lesser quality cloth, and then if they see a foolish person, Westerner or otherwise, they have remnants that don't match at all, and they'll give a dhoti this and a kurta that, just to get rid of the remnants. And if you're not recognizing their cheating propensity, they'll just get rid of the remnants at a good price. But this one merchant doesn't do that. And because they don't do that, people go back again and again and again. That's another principle of Purvaisha, to build their business on the reputation of being fair and honest. And it's just, you know, it's rare that it happens, but it's a better principle to live by, even for a Vaishya. I take a practical example. In America, there's a car that I use in service to Krishna. So it has a lot of miles. It has 130,000 miles. And we just had very, very cold weather. So it was not starting. So somebody recommended you may need to get a full tune-up. So I followed advice, went to a place and said, you don't need a tune-up. That would cost you X. This is what you need. Let me first do this. I think it will solve the problem. And they did this and it solved the problem. And said, he could have, oh, sure. I'll take three times the amount of money that you really need to spend and I'll do a good job. But he said that, I think this will, take care of you. And there was something else that was also needed that wasn't, anyway, so there's some trust. I want to take my car the next time to that guy. So there's some merit in Avaisha being honest. As a principle, as a religious principle, and even as a marketing principle. So while there's some leeway because of the profession to do so, it's difficult to be in that environment and not carry that and speak things that are not full truths and not carry that into the environment of your day-to-day life with other people. You follow? I was riding with one man. I stayed at his home and he was taking us to a program. This was just this past weekend. And I asked him, how long will it take to get there? He said, it'll take 10 minutes. I said, okay. His mobile phone rang. We just got in the car. He said, we'll be there in 2 minutes. And I said, or 10. And he just repeated again, we'll be there in 2 minutes. I said again, or 10. He ended the call and said, Maharaj, what can I do? I used to be an insurance salesman. And so we would say things, to satisfy our customers, tell them what they want to hear. And the tendency is still with me. Even in, social, you don't have to say 2 minutes. You can say 10 minutes. They want to know, the party, that's the host, they want to know when we're going to be there. Just tell them, 10 minutes. Instead of standing at the door 2 minutes wondering, did we get in an accident? Just tell them 10 minutes. So tendency spills over into other areas of life. And when you want to build trust in relationships, you want to speak, when you speak, the person are wondering, is it really like that or is it something else? You want to have a relationship where what you say is what it is, and when I say I'm going to do something, I do it in a timely fashion as I say I'm going to do it. It builds trust. It's a better principle. To the other side, Prabhupada did say it's with the territory of being Vaishya. Buy more and save. Come on. <laughs> 30% free. You know that they're making the money, but they say, buy the big size, the giant size, and you save 30%. You're paying for it. Come on. Be honest. Okay. You're paying for it. Oh, now I know. So now I'm going to buy your product. I'm going to buy them. So it goes with the territory. Spontaneous devotional service. The regulative devotional service is you practice. So when you're doing your household duties, you chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. That's like Mother Jasoda. Mother Jasoda, she was doing her duties for Krishna, and she was spontaneously composing songs, glorifying Krishna's wonderful pastimes. So, that's the other side. The spontaneous side is when actual attachment for Krishna develops. You won't be able to do anything but think of Krishna 24 hours. Whatever you're doing will be external, and the internal is where your consciousness will be because of attachment. So that's where we want to go, is attachment. So we're on this side and the regulative side. So you perform your chanting of your japa very, very attentively. Like this, you come to hear, and then after hearing, you discuss. Oh, this was a nice point. I appreciated that understanding. How wonderful is Kunti? You just immerse your through Krishna Katha, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Svaranam. So do lots of Shravanam, Kirtanam if you want Vishnu Svaranam. And do it in a qualitative way. Another key part of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is having great appreciation for the person who is speaking the message, the representative of Krishna. This is an important lesson right from the first lessons in Bhagavatam. How the importance of a sadhu, receiving a sadhu, the message of a sadhu. This was the theme in the 13th chapter that we discussed last time. It's a theme in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's the answer to your question. To become attached to Krishna, you need to become attached to those who are dear to Krishna. That's Krishna's system. And we become attached to Krishna by hearing from those who are attached to Krishna. So the relationship that we have, the quality of the relationship that we have with those who are dear to Krishna will help determine good quality of that relationship, will determine easiness in remembering Krishna. Because the exchanges and the hearing that you have will strengthen your attachment for Krishna. It's just natural. That's just how it works. You have to translate the question. I'll read it first. In the three reasons mentioned as to why people can't see Krishna, the second reason was that despite training being given, they are stubborn. How to understand and accept if we are stubborn, and how to give up the stubbornness. This could be a long answer, but I'll give a short answer. I'll just give some simple points. Generally, this idea of stubbornness is a trait that Prabhupada gives to the scientists and to the rampant speculators. It's not a quality that primarily is attributed by Prabhupada to the devotee. The devotee is maybe other things. Maybe attached to sense gratification, or maybe lazy, something like that. But the stubborn obstinacy is generally like the donkey. So, that's one point. Having said that, we all have experience that there are some things that we can readily let go of, and there's some other things that we're reluctant to let go of, and there's some other things we just can't seem to let go of. That's a stubborn point. It's an attachment point. So, what to do is the question. How do you recognize what stubbornness is? You know, even after understanding so many instructions, we maintain material attachments. We even may, you know, yeah, and then maintain. We become convinced. So it's holding on to a material conception. The essence of stubbornness is I'm holding on to a material conception, and the thought is, if I don't have this material conception, I'll have nothing. If I don't keep this conception, and based upon this conception, some activities that are meant to bring me happiness, based upon this conception, I'll have no happiness, I'll have nothing. So it's a lack of trust or faith in Krishna. The alternative is far more substantial. I mean, is real substance, and the other is nothing. The holding on to material conceptions. So I would say there's three basic things. One is knowledge. Another is association. Another is cultivation. So with knowledge, I have to recognize, here's the position of a donkey. Stubborn. And we all say, within the animal kingdom, there are different animals or birds that are characteristic of different things. And like mischievousness is monkey. Monkey business. As stubborn as a donkey. Just digs in and doesn't move. So, would we rather be a donkey or would we rather be a horse? Just move freely. In different ways, apply the principle of knowledge to understand the fruitlessness of a life that is prone to stubbornness. I will not be able to progress in spiritual life if I stubbornly hold on to material conceptions. Knowledge in different ways, without exploring all the different applications. Try to understand what that thing is. Being stubborn. Then another is seek good association. Associate with those that you know are very accepting. They don't have the problem of being stubborn. And you can see how free they are because of that. How light and happy and unencumbered they are. It's attractive, and it helps one develop that quality through association. And cultivation. You, just like the pan scale, if something is very heavy over here, you put something over here to balance. If one, for example, if one has a habit of eating too much, you take a balance and you go the other direction. You cultivate eating less. You consciously cultivate the opposite. If you're prone to anger, Bhishma indicates you cultivate forgiveness. You let go of that anger. And the root cause of the anger. If you forgive them, you forgive others. So, stubbornness is you consciously yield to that thing which is the higher thing, the spiritual conception. Even you may not fully understand it or even fully accept it, you just move with it, just practice flexibility instead of rigidity. Cultivation. Knowledge, association, and cultivation. In general, those are principles that apply to developing any quality or eradication of an unwanted quality or characteristic. And then you can make your little chart in your mind or literally on paper of these are points of knowledge, these are action points of association and cultivation. And slowly move. My daughter is devoted toward Lord Krishna and coming far away from our domestic daily life. What's the reason for this and what should we parents, brothers, and sisters do? So it sounds like just like a personal problem, but it's and not so much related to this, but where attraction for Krishna, Queen Kunti, she's mother. She has her domestic duties, and she's strongly attracted to Krishna. And we're going to hear later on how she wants the material affinity that she feels for her parents and that side of her family and her own children to be taken away by Krishna. Now, but she's very dutiful and as a mother and as a daughter, naturally affectionate. So, it's that, just the short answer is this. Where there is attraction, a developing attraction for Krishna in any family member, that's a great asset for the family. It's not that only when someone earns a big sum of money through their livelihood, through their occupation, that's a good asset for the family. Attraction for Krishna is the greatest asset for the family. So how should the family members respond to that? Very good, very good, very good. At the same time, the family member who is developing a strong attraction for Krishna needs to understand the importance of performing routine work very conscientiously. Prabhupada taught us, so the another part, a parallel part of the answer here is, this family member who's developing a strong attraction for Krishna needs to understand the following instruction. A devotee is never negligent in ordinary dealings. Being a devotee, being increasing your devotion to Krishna does not mean neglect ordinary dealings. A devotee is not neglectful in ordinary dealings. A devotee is Krishna conscious in all dealings. Ordinary dealings, extraordinary dealings, all dealings. The devotee is conscious of Krishna, placing Krishna consciousness at the center of all dealings, of all duties of life, including whatever they are, domestic and other. It's not a sign of maturity, it's not a sign of advancement of Krishna consciousness to be neglectful in one's duties of life. So, both the family members who are not as attracted to Krishna and the family member who is attracted to Krishna need to deepen their understandings. This is a great resource for the family. We should encourage it. And the family member who is developing the strong attraction for Krishna needs to be very conscientious in attending to their duties in life. Do them for Krishna, kind of attentiveness. A devotee is more attentive than the attached materialist because they're doing it for Krishna. The attached materialist is doing it because me, 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 me. And the devotee is doing because of Krishna, 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 Krishna. And it's a much stronger motivator or incentive to do things so nicely because it's for Krishna. That part of Krishna conscious training is very important. We don't find, just conclude this way, we don't find in the lives of elevated personalities that their responsibilities just went, you know, into chaos. It's not the case of Yudhisthira Maharaj, it's not the case of Prahlad Maharaj, it's not the case of Ambarish Maharaj, it's not the case of any elevated devotee of the Lord. It's just not how people do things who are Krishna conscious. So look to those standards and be very conscientious in your duties of life. Because they're for Krishna.